So what if everything became strange? Or other? Or nothing? I was nobody home, you see. So these threats lie in the game of playing that the two sides of the world, the black and the white, the I and the thou, the subject and the object, don't go together. Now, we must therefore realize in studying Buddhism that it has this dialectical nature, and that the dialogue which the Buddha started by suggesting that you try to eliminate suffering by eliminating desire. He knew perfectly well you can't eliminate desire, because if you try, that's already a desire to eliminate desire. But he wanted people to try the experiment and see what would happen. They did, and this kind of experimentation went on over hundreds of years, and as it went on, people began to record the various stages through which their experiments went. And as a consequence of this, Buddhism underwent changes. It developed an aspect of itself which was quite different from the first aspect. And we broadly speak of the two schools of Buddhism as being Theravada, which is closest to the original texts, and Mahayana, which is a development. Mahayana simply represents a deeper level of the dialogue. The Theravadins do what people so often tend to do, which is to stay with the authority of the original teacher. In other words, you might say that there are certain people who call themselves Bible Christians. They don't want any truck with the church. Let's stick with the simple teachings of Jesus as they originally were formulated and not have anything added to that. Other people would say, well, that's ridiculous, because if the simple teachings of Jesus are fruitful, they'll make everybody else think of new things, and they'll stimulate changes of consciousness, changes of ideas, and we'll add that all on, and it'll be like an acorn. When it's put into the ground, it no longer looks like an acorn. It turns into a huge tree. So that idea has been fundamental to Buddhism, that it grows as a tree grows. And so that the materials, the teachings of Mahayana Buddhism are contained in scriptures, and it's said that the Buddha gave these scriptures, but not in this world. These are the lectures he gave to the gods, to all kinds of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in somewhere in some other kind of space. Now, what happened historically is, I suppose, this, that the Mahayana scriptures were written by Buddhist monks who had nothing much to do on long, wet afternoons. And they wrote and wrote. Do you know that the Mahayana Buddhist scriptures, when put together, are a set of books larger than the Encyclopedia Britannica? It's simply prodigious. But they are all attributed to the Buddha or to the great bodhisattvas, some of whom are, as it were, cosmological figures who don't incarnate on this level at all. So what happened? Those monks who wrote these things down genuinely felt that they were expressing a wisdom which was not their own. they wouldn't have dreamed of signing their own names to this stuff. They say, this I have understood from my deepest inner self. And that's not stinky little Nagarjuna or somebody. It's the great cosmic Buddha in me who has revealed this. So it's the teaching of the Buddha. And they did this in good faith. So although from one historical point of view the books of Mahayana Buddhism are much later than those of Theravada, or the Pali scriptures, you will often find Mahayanists arguing that they are immeasurably more ancient, because they incorporate a fundamental and eternal wisdom which is preached by the Buddha outside time. So as when we tell a fairy story, we say, once upon a time there was a beautiful prince, and so on, you know. When was that? Long, long ago. Yeah, very long ago. It means this is a timeless tale. You see, there's always liable to be a beautiful prince. But so once upon a time has the same sense as the first word of St. John's Gospel, Enachi, in the beginning was the word. That's in the archetypal, primordial beginnings. So that's where all those sutras come from. They say, thus have I heard. At a certain occasion, the Buddha was in the Tsushita heaven and was surrounded with this, that, and the other. Well, that means this is timeless. But actually, the Mahayana does represent a certain kind of historical evolution. The evolution resulting upon many, many people making serious experiments with the Buddha's original doctrine. They tried to transform their consciousness by eliminating desire. They tried, in other words, to overcome suffering by toughening themselves. And as a result of doing those experiments, they found out certain things about themselves. As a result of introspection, they found out a lot about the nature of consciousness and about the nature of just plain isness, existence. In certain directions, they found out that they'd been fools, that they'd set themselves to discover things that can't be discovered, as if you tried to bite your own teeth, or find out what's round the back of the mirror. And so, as a result of finding out that certain lines of development were dead ends, they didn't follow them anymore. Even though they might suggest to their students that they too investigate those roads. That's the nature again of upaya. Upaya is a clever device to get somebody to realize something which cannot be explained to him intellectually, because he won't believe it. I mean, it's easy enough. I can say, well, everybody here, you know, you're all Buddhas. Every one of you. And I don't know what the hell you're doing around here, except come in for lunch. What do you want to learn? I can't tell you a thing. See, you have it all. And you say, well, that's all very well in theory, but I don't feel it to be so. So we have to go through this big thing of making all these experiments so as to find out that the theory is so. And that you really are, each one of you, the foundation and ground of the universe. Only you're going to find it out in a way where it, shall we say, won't go to your head. Where you'll be able to play it cool that you are the ground of the universe. And it's not something to brag about. On the other hand, it's nothing to be ashamed of and hide. That's the middle way. Madhyamika is the basic form of Mahayana Buddhism, meaning the middle way, which was transmitted to Tibet and lies as ever at the foundation of Tibetan Buddhism. So you see the sort of principles I'm sketching out, the sort of way of synthesis of putting together the worldly life and the spiritual life, the bound life and the free life, the hidden life and the found life. That's Mahayana. And because, you see, it ends up in what Frederick Spiegelberg has called the religion of no religion. This is the end of all this, you see, is to get rid of religion. Like when you go to a doctor and he gives you medicine and it cures you, you throw away the bottle. You don't keep on the stuff. So in Tibetan Buddhism, the aim of it really is to transcend Buddhism. So there are what are called the six precepts of Tilopa. Mano masam machaching, magam masam rangbabzad. Which means, mano, don't think. Masam, have no mind. Machaching, don't meditate. Magam masam, don't contemplate. Don't discipline yourself. Keep your mind in its natural state. That's in Sanskrit called sahaja, naturalness. But nobody in the world can practice this. There's nothing you can do. Like saying to someone, now please, be natural. Could you be natural by any imaginable effort or non-effort? You couldn't possibly do it. You have, therefore, you see, before you can be natural and you suddenly have a feeling that you're not natural, that something's wrong with you, you have to do some very unnatural things so as to find again that you can't be unnatural, even if you try very hard to do so. I can't separate myself from the divine unity by any stratagem whatsoever, but I won't know that that's so unless I try very hard to do so. So we all try, you see, very hard to be individuals, and then to be perfect individuals, to be in charge, to be God, to rule ourselves. And as a result, in the end, we find out that that wasn't necessary. It was like putting legs on a snake, as they say in Zen. So one returns then to the natural state, where religion vanishes. And you can't say, when you look at the Bodhisattva, who is the Buddhist ideal, it's very difficult to distinguish him from an ordinary kind of a secular person.
We've been listening to Alan Watts with part one of the three-part seminar, Wisdom of the Mountains.